All right, welcome again to the Centurions, looking at the 10th century tonight, sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ilun Ishmas Yonah ben Reb Aryeh Leib. 10th century was a watershed in Jewish history, with many great and momentous events taking place. The civilized world was uneasily divided into two great empires, the Byzantine Christians, who extended their reach from Europe to the rivers of Babylon, and the Muslim Empire that stretched from Arabia all the way to Spain. And in the Jewish world, a number of things took place that had long-term consequences. It was the century that resolved a growing dispute over the authoritative texts of the Tanakh, with over 800 minor discrepancies that had fallen into the text of the Tanakh. Most of them vowel issues. It's not as if, there wasn't the word lo when it otherwise would appear. Voweling. So the text of Ben Osher was selected and became the definitive edition of the Tanakh, and it was then that tradition has it that Ben Osher produced the Aleppo Codex. The century that saw the rules of Diktuk take place, also amid many disagreements, and the century that saw the Jewish people and the Torah itself spread across the globe, aided by the infamous tale of the four hostages. So very briefly, the four great Talmid Chachamim that set sail from Bari, Italy, to raise funds for their respective yeshivos, Mishulachim. Pirates seize the ship, I guess the fantasy of any homeowner. Pirates seize their ship before they can come to any community, and the full ransom by a number of Jewish communities, which they in turn served as teachers of Torah, in some cases really foundational teachers of Torah. One, Rabbeinu Hushiel, went to Karawan in Tunisia, is the father of Rabbeinu Hananel. A second, Rabbeinu Shmaria, went to Cairo, Egypt. A third, not definitive, but it's alleged to be Rav Nosson HaBavli, went to France, and the fourth, the most famous, Rav Moshe ben Chanoch, transformed Cordoba, Spain, and turned it into the center of Jewish learning. Now, Babel was distinguished in the 10th century by a number of giants, none greater than Rav Sadia Gaon, who was unique in that he was the only Gaon in this whole period who was not a Babylonian by origin. Rav Sadia was born in Egypt in 892, he was an Egyptian. He came to Babel relatively late in life, didn't live a long life. After writing a famous work on the Karaites, refuting the Karaites, and the work itself gained him renown in the Jewish world. So that led to his appointment as the Gaon of Sura, notwithstanding that he wasn't a Babylonian, but he didn't take well to the position. And he lived a life almost bouncing from one dispute to the next. One very famous controversy I spoke about a number of years ago, the calendar dispute in 920, in which the leader of the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael ruled that Pesach would begin on a Sunday the next year and not a Tuesday, as it was in the rest of the Jewish world. And it was about 2 years when the Jews in Israel, completely different schedule until he was essentially renounced. And more significantly for Absadja, see, he was involved in resolving that dispute, wrote a sefer, in fact, showing that the Reb Aaron from Israel was wrong. But more significantly, a dispute with the Reish Galusa that led to mutual charamim. He put the Reish Galusa in Cheirem, Reish Galusa put him in Cheirem, and Absadja had to go into hiding for 7 years. So as such, his immediate influence on his contemporaries was not as great on his influence on subsequent generations that came about because of his great work, his magnum opus, written in Arabic, called Al-Makhtar fi Al-Amanat ve'Ala At-Kadat, which we know better as Hanivchar be'Emunot u'Vidayot, the choices of beliefs and opinions. It was the very first systematic work of Jewish philosophy, spelling out exactly what Jews believe, and especially contrasting it when necessary, or when appropriate, with Islamic beliefs. But he died young, probably at age 50, and had a very difficult life, but nonetheless is one of the great figures of our history. But he's not the centurion. I'll just mention another one or two great people. towards the end of the century, Rav Shri Ragon was the Rosh Hashiva in Sura, and he wrote also a famous Igeres, basically a history of the Mesorah and the Torah Shebaal Peh. But Bavel itself, by the 10th century, was in decline, a decline that was both temporarily halted, as well as highlighted by the reign of Rav Hai Gaon, Rav Shir Gaon's son. So Rav Hai Gaon was a world-class Gaon, made the leading Talmud Chacham certainly the leading Talmud Chacham in that part of the world. He died in 1038, so he arrested the decline of Bavel, but it was with his death that the Tkufas HaGaon formally ended, because there was no one even remotely reaching his stature to follow him. The decline of Bavel, though, saw the hub of Jewish life shift to Europe, to Spain, and then Franco-Germany, spurred by the greatest man of the age, and really of many ages, known to us as Rabbeinu Gershom Meor HaGolo, Rabbeinu Gershom, the light of the exile, and our centurion for the 10th century. So how great was Rabbeinu Gershom? Rashi says of him in his Tshuvos, Shemipiv onu chayin kulanu, we all live from his mouth, meaning he sustains all of us. V'chol b'nei golos Ashkenaz, tamidei tamidovein, and all of the Ashkenazic exile, we are all the students of his students. Without him, really, I don't want to say there's no Torah, but the Torah is not the same. Rabbeinu Gershom really straddled two centuries. He was born in 960, born in Metz in France, and he died either in 1028 or 1040, most say in 1040, which means that he lived an equal amount of time in both centuries. He was born in France, but he lived most of his life in Mainz, Germany. In fact, that's where he went to learn, and where he became the Rosh Hashiva as well. He took on that appellation, Me'or HaGola, the light of the exile, because before his time, German Jews turned to the Gedolim in Eretz Yisrael to answer their questions. And now literally, he became the Me'or HaGola, he was the light of the exile. Interestingly, he is described as the Talmud of Rav Hai Gaon. How could that be? And the answer is, apparently Rav Hai Gaon visited Mainz in Rabbeinu Gershom's youth, and Rabbeinu Gershom claimed to get his derech and learning from Rav Hai Gaon. So he considered him a primary Rebbe. But he was mainly a Talmud of Rav Yehuda Leontine, who was the Rosh Yeshiva in Mainz. He started the yeshiva in Mainz, a yeshiva that attracted students from across France and Germany. Rabbeinu Gershom, in his Tshuvos, calls his Rebbe Reb Leon, meaning Yehuda, Lion, Shelimdeni Rov Talmudi, who taught me most of the learning that I have. Not much is known about Rabbeinu Gershom's youth, aside from that. And it's very interesting that, you see, Chazal never dwelled much on biographical data that fleshes out the character or the personality of an individual where it's really not relevant to a story. You see that from the Torah, by the way. We know a lot about Avram and Yitzhak and Yaakov and Moshe, but we know very little, considering how long they lived and the vast stretches of time in their lives where the Torah reports absolutely nothing. Even in the Sedra of the last few weeks, Moshe Rabbeinu essentially disappears from our story from age 20 to age 80. That's 60 years. So what happened to him? So the Medrash fills in the blanks. But the Torah is silent. If it's not directly relevant to the story of Moshe Rabbeinu as Rabbeinu, or Avram Avinu as Avram Avinu, so the Torah doesn't mention it. So too with the Gedolim. So we don't know much about Rabbeinu Gershom. We know that his wife, he married young, but his first wife died, and he remarried a woman named Bona. And we know, of course, that he succeeded his Rebbe, Rav Yehuda Leontin, as the Rosh Yeshiva in Mainz in the year 1000. And he already had a reputation, and even more students then flocked to Germany to learn with him. And it was in that year as well that a remarkable convocation was called that defined Jewish life in that era and for centuries to come, and in many respects until today. And it was Rabbeinu Gershom's undisputed authority that led to a number of takanos that really made his reputation that we have until today and transformed Jewish life. Known as the takanos of Rabbeinu Gershom, in another context, the charamim of Rabbeinu Gershom. So there are several that are worthy of discussion. The first, and probably the most famous, is the ban on polygamy. So Mechaber writes this in the Shulchan Aruch and Eben HaEzer, Siman Aleph, Sif Yud. Rabbeinu Gershom hecherim al hanosei al ishto. Rabbeinu Gershom decreed a cherim on any person who would take a wife in addition to his current wife. But he did not decree a cherem against the Yavama, meaning the Mechaber holds that he kept the institution of Yibum extant. If a man would die, leaving his widow childless and having a brother, so that Rabbeinu Gershom, according to Mechaber, would permit the brother to marry the Yavama. Or an arusa as well, meaning if someone gives kiddushin to a woman and for some reason does not effectuate the marriage with her, nisuin, Rabbeinu Gershom there would allow him as well to take a second wife. Now there are differences between the Mechaber and the Ramah, that is to say between the various Rishonim that they quote and how this takon of Rabbeinu Gershom was understood. So Ramah says, and I'll read most of the sif so we get a flavor of the takonah. Ramah says, "Emeina rotze lechnos el liftor." In the case of arusa, if he doesn't want to marry her, but he wants to dismiss her, send her away, and she's not leaving, so he could take a second wife. V'hu adin mechol makom sheish gichui mitzvah. So to in any case where you would have to otherwise postpone the fulfillment of a mitzvah. Such as the case where you live 10 years with a woman and have no children with her. So there the Mordechai said, and the Rashba, and the Maran Padua, that here Rabbeinu Gershom did not extend his takana. That's their opinion, as quoted in the Ramah. But the Ramah continues, Amnam, Yesh Cholkim, the Sovrale, the Cherim and Gershom, Noheg, Afil, the Makom Mitzvah, the Afil, the Makom Yibum, the Tzarech Lachalots. Others say, and Mordechai also brings this down, that the Cherim of Rabbeinu Gershom, the ban of polygamy, applied as well to a case of a mitzvah. Whether it's the childless couple, whether it's the case of Yibum, the Tzarech Lachalots. And you see, I mean, in our day, of course, certainly in the Ashkenazi world for centuries already, we don't have Yibam anymore, but you do have Chalitza where appropriate. In a case where the first wife cannot be divorced for one of two reasons. Let's say she's incompetent, can't receive a get. Or he wants to divorce her, but she refuses to receive a get. Yesh lahakel lahatir lo ilisa acheres. So too, the chaim would not apply in such a case. We make it allow him to marry someone else as well. In the case of arusa, well, that's the Ramah. Now the Mechaber continues. Vilo poshta takanosa bechol aratzos. This takan of Rabbeinu Gershom did not extend to all communities. We'll discuss in a few minutes that it didn't extend to his community. It didn't extend to the Sephardic world. And the Ramah continues now. We only say that it doesn't apply in a place where we know for sure that it did not apply. But generally we would say it applies everywhere. And he discusses the case, let's say a person goes from a place where they're sour on polygamy to a place where they embrace it with open arms. Which minig is he bound by? That's a different issue. You have a practical shaila, ask me later. The Mechaber continues, V'lo hecherim elo atzofa elef hachamishi, that the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom applied only to the end of the fifth millennium, meaning the year 5000. Year 5000 corresponds to the year 1240, which is a little less than 800 years ago. So according to the Mechaber, the ban ended quite a while ago, freeing up a lot of dating possibilities for people. But the Rama says no. Mikomakam b'chomadinos elu atakanav aminagim koma omed. In all our communities, the takana remains in force. Ve'enosin sheinoshim, we do not marry two women. V'chofin macharamos v'niduyin mishover v'nosei beiznoshim lagorish achas mehen. And a person who does marry two women, we force him through charamos and other threats to divorce one of them. Yesh omer bizman hazeh ein lochof mishov acher mena gerishom echa shekar nishlam elef hachamishi. The Ma'arik, right in the 15th, 16th centuries, said that since it's way past the stated end of the decree, if a person would marry two wives, we would not force them to divorce. They know again, Cain, our muscles again, that's not our minig. Every person gets just one wife. Yesh omrim, I'm just finishing the Ramah. Misha hemira ishto, the person whose wife becomes an apostate. Mizake lo get aide acher venose acheres. Some say he's allowed to give her a get through Zikli. Zikli means you have someone else accept the get for her, and the get therefore exists and is extant, and he can marry someone else. Uvemakom she'ein minog ein lahachamir umuta lisa cheres below gerusha harishona. In a case where there's no minog, you don't have to be machmir, you can marry someone else without divorcing the first. Sounds archaic, but in fact I heard of such a case not long ago where a woman became an apostate and the question was to give a get ayde zikui or just allow him to marry without the get. That case is still relevant. Alright, so why this measure? Of course, underlying it is the recognition that the Torah permits a man to marry more than one wife, not a woman, but a man. So all he did here was in the classic tradition of Chazal that they could be ochre, something from the Torah, b'shev al tasa, just be passive, don't do something. Chazal could tell us not to do something that we ordinarily can do, as opposed to saying, do something that you ordinarily can't do. But why? Why all of a sudden did he do this? So Rishona mentioned a number of things. One is that even the Gemara only supported polygamy where the husband was able to support each wife appropriately, she'er ksus and ono, and this became difficult and became very contentious, and Rabbeinu Geshem saw in his own time that it became a source of licentiousness, that men were being a mezalzel, degrading women by marrying them, we're talking low lives of course, marrying them and then not supporting them. So once it became exploitative of women, Jewish wives lost the basic protection of the ksuba as a result, and therefore Rabbeinu Gershom removed the option of multiple marriage from men. Other reasons were added later on in the early Achronim. One, I guess we can understand, Shalom Bayis, the wives protested. Another reason, because Jews were forced to flee constantly in this time because of Christian persecution. So fear was that families would become separated and a man would take a wife in another locale altogether, have children in several places who would ultimately marry each other. Probably the most famous reason, which you don't find in Rishona, but much later, the Yaivitz in the 18th century, Yaakov Emden, writes in his Truvos, that there was a sakana, his word, in Jews marrying several wives in a Christian society that banned polygamy and grudgingly approved of marriage itself. So Jews could not be perceived as less moral than Christians. So therefore, a society which frowned for moral reasons on polygamy, so Jews had to at least reach that level so people shouldn't say there's a Kedusha Kala in Jewish life and a Kedusha Chamura in non-Jewish life. If that's the reason, that's the Yaivitz's reason, so I'm not sure what we would say today. I mean, today we have a very loose attitude towards marriage generally. You know, I just saw that, there was a picture in the Wall Street Journal today of New York's new governor, Andrew Cuomo, walking out of church with his live-in girlfriend. Went yesterday to church. And his kids also, from his first wife, or his only wife to date. Because I saw the picture, I said to myself, is there no shame anymore in the world? I mean, you go to church with a paramour and the priest doesn't say anything? It just, it doesn't compute. It wasn't like that even 20, 30 years ago. There used to be some shame. But now you read day after day, people having wives and mistresses and openly, it's not even hidden anymore. I mean, that minor from Chile from a few months ago, who had to choose who he wanted to greet him when he finally was rescued, his wife or his mistress. And I remember Mitterrand's funeral in France, both his wife and his mistress attended, his both grieving, both Torquia, who would think such a thing in our world? But it exists, so in a world where marriage itself has become a degraded institution, it doesn't seem that the Yaivitz's reason holds true anymore. But the reason really goes back to the original thinking of Rabbeinu Gershom, and in fact, the Yaivitz aside, you have to be able to support financially, emotionally, a number of women, and most men struggle with the one. Now, obviously, there are many ramifications to this. It's very clear from the Chaber when he said, "V'lo pasha takanosa b'chol aratzos," that it was not accepted in a good part of the world. It was never accepted in Eidot HaMizrach, or Spain, or even Provence in southern France, or Egypt, or Israel, not to mention the rest of Arabia. When Israel had to wrestle with this problem in the early 50s, so they essentially fudged the difference, banning polygamy, but permitting it to an individual who seeks it, especially in the case of the childless couple, when, if rather, the couple or the man receives the explicit written permission of both chief rabbis, both the Sephardi and Ashkenazi chief rabbis, assuming they never agree on anything. But in fact, you do have in Israel, until today, maybe once or twice a decade, there'll be a person who takes a second wife, again, Yotzei Eidot HaMizrach, to whom it was never formally banned. It's also clear from the Ramah that the ordinance was meant to be in effect only until the year 5000, it's 1240 of the Common Era, and after that we say that today it's a minig that's accepted by all Ashkenazic Jews. So you see anyway the force of a minig. We should never disparage or depreciate what a minig is. This minig is so ingrained in Jewish life that in fact it has the force of Torah law. Now part of the takana alluded to here was that Rabbeinu Gershom permitted in certain cases Yeshua Hakel Lahatilo Lisa Cheras. We could permit a person, the Makom Mitzvah, to marry another wife, Nose Isha Al Ishto. But who's to be Mekil? So this gave rise, really was his formulation, to the Heter Me Rabbonim. The Heter Me Rabbonim is a permission given by 100 rabbis that allows the man to fulfill the Torah's obligation of marriage when his wife has become incapacitated, or in fact, the Makom Mitzvah, according to most. At the Me'er Rabbonim is literal. The Beis Shmuel says, Me'a Anashim, Mishalosh Kehilos, Migimel Aratzos. 100 rabbis from 3 communities in 3 different lands. Alright, so in Europe, it'd be 3 cities. In Israel, 3 cities. America, 3 cities. And that's basically how it's done today as well. This way, you can't have undue pressure placed on any one community. So in such cases, the husband is allowed to marry another woman, and he's obligated to put into escrow money equivalent to his wife's dowry and her ksuba, as well as mizonos, that is to say, support for the rest of her life. It's a fairly uncommon procedure. It doesn't happen that often, but it does happen, and it's always a trying, in our day especially, at least I should say in our world especially, when it occurs, it's always as a result of some tragic illness. Outside our world, in other communities, you do find that it's abused, and simply a husband who refuses to give his wife a get, he'll go and have Mea Leit Sanim, 100 clowns, sign a document allowing him to remarry. In my experience, I've encountered four, I've chosen to sign two, and did not sign two. The reasons don't really matter, but it does happen. So in 25 and a half years, I've seen four. Daramo himself, you see, the final case, offers two opinions as to what can be done when the wife becomes an apostate. Now, commonly, when a woman became, or a man for that matter, but somebody became an apostate, disappeared into the Christian community. So they could not be found in order to give a get. So in such a case, you have the two opinions of the Rama. One says get either zikui, and the other says a get is not necessary altogether, and the husband can remarry. Now the takana had a very dramatic effect in an unexpected way, and is very relevant to today because of a corollary to nosei isha al ishto, and that became a second takana of Rabbeinu Gershon, but very much related to the first. Under the law of the Torah, a woman can be divorced against her will. She does not have to consent to the divorce. The chosav law sefer krisus v'nosan b'yado. The husband writes a get and gives it to his wife, puts it in her hand. Now, it's unilateral, but it's not as harmful as it might seem, because when polygamy was permitted, the grusha, the divorcee, could just take her money from the ksuba, he had to pay her 200 zuz, whatever other money she had coming to her, and she could relatively easily attach herself to another man. She's coming with money. But when the Chayim of Rabbeinu Gershon banned polygamy, so the laws of divorce had to be adjusted as well. What Rabbeinu Gershon did is he balanced the scales somewhat. This you find later in Evan Ezer, in Hilchos Gittin, Siman Kuf Yotes Vav. Mechaber says again, the Din Torah, Yochel Lagarsha Belo Daita, a man is allowed to divorce a woman against her will, even without her knowledge. Alright? But Rama adds, I'm quoting the middle now, V'chol Zem Midina, that's the halacha, of Rabbeinu Gershom Hecharim, Shelo Lagare Shisha Shelo Midaita, Imlo Sha'over Al Das. Rabbeinu Gershom also decreed that a woman could not be divorced against her will. That now a woman's consent has to be achieved before divorce is effected, except again if she's an apostate. So this even the scales of divorce, and today it renders it almost impossible to divorce a woman against her will. Not widely known, but probably 20% of the cases of aguna that we have in America are cases where the woman refused to receive a get, and a man wants to give it and she refuses, and you have to somehow accommodate her. 80% is the reverse, where the man refuses to give a get and the wife wants to receive. But I was involved in such a case where a woman refused to receive a get, and she had to be assuaged. So again, a husband now faces cherem for divorcing his wife against her will. If she is divorced against her will, all right, and she remarries, then the husband is off the hook. And the cherem, Halacha says, applies as well to the Edim, to the Sofer, all those involved who administered the get. So of course this was a revolution in our understanding of marriage and divorce. Divorce is no longer completely unilateral as it was in the days of the Torah, and this has an effect on our world until today. There's a third ban that's very interesting in light of some recent experiences that we've had here. Kriyas Ksav Chavero. Rabbeinu Gershom also banned reading private correspondence without the permission or knowledge of the sender. Even opening a letter, a private letter, without reading it, violates the cherem. So what this did is essentially maintain the privacy of merchants and traders and stabilize commerce between Jews and between Jews and non-Jews. Obviously, businesses could be ruined, not to mention governments, if private letters or invoices or business plans or bills of lading, etc., became part of the public domain. So that was all enforced midin cherem. Now, in truth, today we look at the charamim and basically brush them off as insignificant because our community is not as cohesive as it once was. But in medieval times, in the 10th century for sure, and for centuries after that, to be in cherem meant to be estranged from the Jewish community. and a person was estranged from the Jewish community and not part of the Christian community was essentially that man who was an island and had no natural ties. Chayim was a very powerful threat. Here it's no threat at all. You put some chayim in this shul, but go to another shul, and that's the end of it. You don't like this community, go to another community. So when the community is not cohesive and supportive, then charamim are not going to matter at all. But you see, there's an interest, it's a very sophisticated interest Rabbi Gershom saw in preventing, in trying to maintain confidentiality and preventing the unnecessary usurping of the privilege that we have to exchange private communications. Granted, it was always asur. Gemara speaks at length about it. It was always asur to reveal a private confidence or to break into someone's email. Gemara mentions specifically not to break into someone's email, Michal. But nonetheless, what he did was add the force of chayrim to it, that would be grounds for excommunication. That character from WikiLeaks is not only childish and immature, but he's also devoid of common sense. He's like living on the level of a five-year-old where there are no secrets. Which I retract that. Even five-year-olds have no slim secrets. They keep secrets too. There was another takon as well, Rabbeinu Gershom, and that bore particular meaning for him, and that is not to discriminate or disparage returning converts. So here a very poignant chapter in Rabbeinu Gershom's life. In 1012, one of the priests in Mainz converted to Judaism. You heard me right. One of the priests in Mainz, a Catholic priest, converted to Judaism. It wasn't that common then, really until our day, for no other reason that he was then burned at the stake. But once that happened, the church authorities then demanded that all the Jews of Mainz convert. Most Jews responded by fleeing Mainz. One of those who didn't was Rabbeinu Gershom's son, stayed with his father, and he was seized and forcibly converted. And again, on pain of death, he was not allowed to return to the Jewish community. And this became a source of great bitterness in Rabbeinu Gershom's life. Or Zerua refers to the story very briefly with a reference to a minhag that started with Rabbeinu Gershom that became more common over the centuries and is practically non-existent in our day. Miu b'shasa suhilchas avelus. Miu b'shasa shmad shamati mimori rav Rabbeinu Shimshon zatzal shirabi Gershom nisabel al benoka shenishtamed arba asar yom. That Rabbeinu Gershom, he heard, sat shiva when his son became an apostate for 14 days. Kalvachomel l'shchino yudalad yom. So if you're sitting for a body for 7 days, a human being, so when his soul was lost as well. That's the Or Zeruah, and that became the source of a custom that was extant throughout the history of European Jewry, that if someone went off the derech and became a convert, the family would sit shiva. You had even in our world, someone intermarried, for example. But those days seem to be long gone. Now the Mordechai in Moed Kan seems to indicate, it's an addendum to the text, that not that he sat shiva when he converted, but that he sat shiva after his son died. His son predeceased him. And that's when he sat shiva for 14 days. 7 for his body and 7 for his soul, because his son was never zocha to do tshuva. But that's an addendum in the Mordechai. It's not clear from the basic text whether it was before or after death, nor whether in fact that was normative, but simply meaning it should apply thenceforth, but simply done because Rabbeinu Gershom's tsar in this case was so great. Popularly, I would think that it's the language of the Or Zeruah that has come down to us through tradition, and that became the source of that custom. But Rabbeinu Gershom did ordain, again with the force of Chayrem, that Jews who converted and then did tshuva, returned to Torah, may not be abused or ridiculed or tormented by the community. And Rashi himself refers to this in his Shas and Tshuvas and Siman Ayin. V'achshav noda sh'Rabbeinu Gershom gozar shekol hamazkir zeh yehei benidui. Rabbeinu Gershom himself said, anyone who mentions to a returned convert that he had shamed the Jewish people, that person is benidui. He's in Chayram as well. The case that Rashi dealt with was two families were feuding very bitterly, and then one, in the heat of passion, disparaged the other for having in their family an apostate who came back. And that family then demanded silence, Hus, you can't say that because of Rabbeinu Gershom's decree. And the other family was too late, and the utterer was put in Chayram. And the question that came to Rashi was, is this an eternal Chayram, the rest of his life, or can the Chayram somehow be lifted? So Rashi answers that he's not arguing Rabbeinu Gershom, Me'or HaGola, Shemipiv Onu Chayim, we live because of him. He's in no position to lift the Chayram, and only if the offended agrees is the Chayram to be annulled. Otherwise, it's a lifetime Chayram. There were other takanos as well. Some say there are dozens of other takanos, but it's arguable whether in fact they were Rabbeinu Gershom's, or he was simply a tall tree on which to hang other takanos of other generations, meaning they were attributed to him later for credibility's sake. He also wrote Slichos. Most famously, one of the pizmonim we have during the Aseret Mechuba, and we recited that in the Ne'ilah as well, Zechor Bris Avraham Lakedas Yitzchak. That piyut is Rabbeinu Gershom Or HaGolos. He wrote by hand an edition of the Talmud. He became the first after the era of the Sabaraim to emend the text when it conflicted with a variety of manuscripts. So he wrote one in his own hand, as well as a commentary that sometimes refers to these changes. A few Masechtas and Shas have his commentary on the side as well. Usually we find Rabbeinu Hananel, some Masechtas are Rabbeinu Gershom. With that, Rabbeinu Tam later insisted that among the Charamim of Rabbeinu Gershom was anyone else who would emend the Talmud. But that would seem to have come on a much later date. The Kolbo in Sima Kuf Design lists others as well. Shelo limsor chavero v'lo mamono b'de'akum, not to inform on other Jews, the money to non-Jews. The shelo lavio bar kol shelohem, not to bring Jews to secular court, non-Jewish court. Afilu lasal shalom b'lom chavero, even if the intentions are good, to make peace. If not for the fear that the plaintiff will suffer some grievous monetary loss, then he can quickly go to our cause. Again, all these things are asur. What Rabbeinu Gershom did was apply to them the force of Chayram. Well, Rabbeinu Gershom was the Posek Hador, and almost all of us here are descendants of European Jews, if not all of us, he's the very first Posek Hador that we had in Europe, and a very dynamic force of his students. The mention of Yaakov ben Yochar and Reb Yitzchak Halevi, both of whom became the primary teachers of Rav Shlomo ben Yitzchak, better known to us as Rashi, whom we're told was born in 1040, in the same year that Rabbeinu Gershom died, and in fact was able to study Gemara in Mainz from the manuscript that Rabbeinu Gershom himself had written. This is how the Rosh would refer to Rabbeinu Gershom some three centuries later in his Tshuvos. Chochom Echad Hoya Bar Tzeinu. It was a wise man in our lands. V'hoya Shmo Rabbeinu Gershom. And his name was Rabbeinu Gershom. Tikei Takonos Tovos. Binyan Gershon, he made many fine ordinances in the area of divorce. V'hoya b'mei ha-ge'onim zal, he was in the time, the era of the Ge'onim, or the very end of the era of the Ge'onim, and the beginning of the Tzkufas HaRishonim. V'takonosov u'gzerosov kevuos u'tkuos ke'ilu nitnu mi-sinai. And his decrees and his ordinances are firmly established as if they were given to us at Sinai, Bishvil Shekiblum Aleihem, who Misarum Lador Dor, because we all accepted them, and because they're transmitted from generation to generation. It's that Torah and that Misorah that became ingrained in the Jews of Europe because of the intellectual greatness and the force of personality of Rabbeinu Gershom Meor HaGolah. I thank you all very much. Next week we'll look at the 11th century centurion.